Continuous improvement comes in lots of different flavors and styles. I'm Bella Engelbach, and I'm inviting you to journey with me to the edges of lean.
Episode 121, Continuously Improving Persuasion with Carlos Alvarenga. I believe lean thinking is the best way to manage a business and develop people. But even though I have a lot of experience and many great examples to share, that doesn't mean I am always successful in persuading other people. Carlos Alvarenga is a communications researcher who has delved into what it takes to be persuasive. He joined me at the Edges of Lean to talk about his new book, The Rules of Persuasion, and to explain why persuasion is a skill we can all learn. Carlos Alvarenga, welcome to the Edges of Lean.
Bella, good morning. Thank you for having me on your show.
I'm so glad that you're here today. And I would love for you to have an opportunity to let the Edges of Lean audience know a little bit about yourself. So can you tell us what your career path was and what it is that you're doing today?
Well, I'm going to do it in reverse order.
Okay, go ahead. The best way for you. Yeah.
Right. So I am an independent researcher and writer. And by that, I mean that I research and write, but I don't do it for an institution. I do it on my own. I'm also a doctoral student these days at the University of Maryland in language and rhetoric. I came to this role after a 20 plus year career as a management consultant. The last roles were a partner at Accenture and Ernst & Young. After that, as an executive advisor to C-suite executives at World 50. And I started my career way back as a journalist after undergrad. So that is my background. And I say today, I read and I write, which I'm happy to do every day.
Oh, that's a wonderful way to spend your time, that reading and writing. Wow. And so you've had that career as a management consultant. And I know a lot of people who listen to this show are doing some kind of consulting. They may be working inside an organization as a lean or continuous improvement consultant. They may be working for a company that does that as part of their suite of offerings. And so I think what you're going to be talking about today is going to be very helpful to all of us who are in that kind of work, because it really is about being able to persuade people to change something, right? Right. So tell us a little bit about the book that you've written.
So the book started several years ago when I left business and I began to write. I wanted to volunteer with nonprofits. And there's a website that matches volunteers with nonprofits called Catch a Fire. So I signed up. I go on the website and I get matched with the chairman and CEO of a wonderful nonprofit that does disaster relief all over the world. And his project was something like, help, I'm a boring speaker. I can't read a script. I'm not doing too well. I can't hold an audience attention and my team has had it. So can somebody help me? And I met him and there were a couple of things we needed to work on. And one of them was he hadn't really thought about what persuasion is and that he was trying to persuade people to support his cause or donate or volunteer. And I ordered a few books from Amazon on persuasion. And when I read them, I realized none of them were about persuasion. They were about influence or about negotiation or about psychology. They really weren't about this one really interesting word. And so I went back to a book I'd read in college called The Rhetoric by the philosopher Aristotle, which is in large part about persuasion. I turned it into a PowerPoint deck and I told this gentleman, let's go through this deck together and I think it'll be very helpful. We did. He was really happy with the outcome. He invited me to a second project, which also went really well. Fast forward a year, I had done a dozen of these projects with founders and CEOs. And my wife said, you should really write this down because I think you've done a good job of explaining and modernizing the ideas in the rhetoric. And so I did an outline, sent it to an agent. Agent said, if you write the book, I'll get it sold. And so 3 years later, the book was written, edited, published, and it was released last fall as The Rules of Persuasion by Post Hill Press.
So the Rules of Persuasion. So, all right. So let's take me back, Carlos, because you said that when you started to look at these other books, you saw that they were about influence, right? Mm. And I think, I mean, certainly in my mind, influence and persuasion are very closely related. So can you explain these sort of these different aspects of what people think of persuasion and then what persuasion really is? And because you also said it was, you know, some of them were about psychology, and I would imagine there is some psychology involved. So
there is, but let's take an example from maybe the most famous book on an influence, which is Cialdini's. It's a classic book, which is called Influence. And he, one of his chapters is he describes an effect in which if I'm going to ask you for a favor, I do one for you ahead of time. I give you a gift, right? And so I sort of preload obligation on you. So to me, that's not persuasion. That's psychology, maybe bordering on manipulation. Persuasion is different. Persuasion is getting someone to do something completely willingly. And so the definition I use, by the way, which is important because when I coach people, I ask them, the very first thing I say is persuasion is dot, 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 finish that sentence. And in over 36 clients, I've never had anyone who can answer that question with confidence. And I say, the reason I ask you this is that it's very hard to be good at something if we can't define it. So let's define it. And I want to use Aristotle's definition, which is persuasion is a demonstration that something is true or seems to be true. Full stop. That's it. Very simple, but it has many implications. The most important one being that I don't persuade you. Truth or its appearance persuades you. So I don't want to change your mind. What I want you to do is get you to believe that something that I think is true or claim to be true is true. And so once you start from that definition, you go into a very different direction than all the other books, you know, modern books I read on this topic, right? Because my job is to get you to willingly, rationally, in full possession of your faculties, not by trickery or manipulation or by some other you know, trait of human nature, just through language to get you to believe something. That's what it is.
Right. Okay. Right. So that's really interesting because I mean, my mind immediately goes also to like where we are in a political environment where, you know, where people are, you know, there are lots of different groups with different ends in mind who are trying to persuade us about what is true and showing us pieces of things and saying, well, this is the truth and therefore believe this thing. But we're not going to talk about politics today. That's just a unless we end up there, who knows?
Yeah, but that's not our goal today, right?
We'll see where it goes. But this that idea. So just to make sure that I have it straight. So when we're talking about influence, and I like what you said. That was almost in some cases verging on manipulation, right? So if I want you, Carlos, to do something, or to change something that you're doing, I could do something for you first, in which case in a social environment, you now owe me, so you need to do something for me. And depending on the power relationship in that relationship, whether it's, you know, it's a boss employee or, you know, client consultant, whatever, that could actually almost be dangerous, right? That could tip over into manipulation, right? So that's not what we're talking about here.
And you can think of it as a spectrum, Bella, where you have, let's just say you have persuasion, and then you have what you would say is sort of manipulation, and then you have coercion.
Coercion, right.
The other end of the spectrum. And so if your boss says to you, do it or you're fired, you're coerced.
Right.
If your boss says, do it because I think it's a really good idea, even though you don't, you've been manipulated. If the boss persuades you this is the right thing to do, and you do it whether your boss quit tomorrow or not, then you were persuaded. And I tell executives, if your ideas walk out the door with you at night, if your projects would die if you quit tomorrow, you haven't persuaded anyone. You've manipulated or you've coerced. And I saw as a consultant initiatives that were big projects that the executive left and the next day disappeared. Well, because no one was persuaded. They had been manipulated or coerced in supporting a project, but nobody really believed that it was true that this thing was critical to the organization, right? And I think this is a very dangerous risky area, especially for leaders who don't understand this question of status. And I say that because in the book, the overriding theme of the book goes something like this. erase the idea that persuasion is a soft skill or some undefined trait or something you're born with. It's not. It's chemistry with language. And what I explain in the book is what Aristotle says in his book is that there are three modes of persuasion. The character of the person speaking and or entity, right? Because it could be a school, a company, a government. There are the arguments presented, logic, proofs, witnesses, laws, standards. And there's the emotion the audience feels when you speak. And what I do in my book is say, okay, well, what do you mean by that? So I take character and I break into seven parts. I take argument, I break that into seven parts. And I take emotion and break that into seven kinds of emotion. And I say, okay, now we have 21 little pieces. The best way to understand these 21 pieces is to go back to high school chemistry and think of it as a periodic table of persuasion. Yeah. Every message ever built, and I've looked at thousands, people to gods, gods to gods, gods to people, they all are some combination of a few of these elements, just like everything in our world is some combination of elements from the real table. So what a great communicator knows is the chemistry of persuasion, right? And one of the seven elements of character is called status. And so you can use it, but you need to understand it. And people get status wrong all the time. And this is the point, right? You misuse the element called status. And that's why, although you should have persuaded, you didn't.
This is really critical for people who are undergoing a lean transformation in their organization. I know that you saw some of this, or you saw this in your consulting work.
Right.
That it is a common story, excuse me, unfortunately, that people will, do a really good lead deployment. They'll have the organization humming along. The leader leaves and it all falls apart. And we've seen this happen multiple times. Obviously, we're missing something as we're doing that. Tell us about some of the other elements of character.
Yeah, so character, status is one, right? Status is interesting because status works bidirectionally. That means I can persuade because I remind you that I have a higher status than you, or I can persuade by negating it. For example, undercover boss, right? Some big shot pretends to be a waiter for a week and she learns something. And we believe that because she has negated her status as CEO, right? And so status is one. Origin, which is the most important one. Origin is where does character come from, right? Mm-hmm. So, in fact, the more elite, the more tribal the group, the more important origin is. We have this very, very ancient thing where those of us who have a common origin, we want to believe. Right. So origin is key. It's what where did you go to school? What did you grow up? Right. These are all origin tests that we are given by people. There is language. There is style. There are categories. Right. Categories are the things, sets into which we can be placed. Men, women, executive, non-executive, American, Japanese, right? Republican, Democrat, whatever. There are associations. Associations are interesting because they're the connections the audience makes that we're not aware of. Before we even speak, you walk into a room, before you said a word, the audience is already linking you to things. And they can take Lean, for example, right? So we have somebody who joins the company, here does a Lean project, and they're going to go to their first Lean meeting. And the meeting's going to be led by you. Before you said a word, 100 connections have been made. I like Lean. I hate Lean. I wasn't a good Lean project in my other company. I wasn't a bad Lean project in my other company. I've heard about you that you're nice. I heard about that you're not nice, right? Et cetera, et cetera. And so all that is already in place. And what's called predisposition. That person has been predisposed to lean, no pun intended, to lean in towards you or to pull back before you've even said a word.
Wow. And that's something that I would think many of us have very little awareness of, right? We talk about the idea of having self-awareness and having emotional intelligence, but I mean, how many of us think about, before I walk in the room, what are people already thinking about me and or about what I'm about to say? And then also then I would think not letting that jam up our own head about, I need to do this because they might think, well, they might look at me and say, well, she's a boomer. What do boomers know? And exactly.
Good
And so if
example.
I walk in thinking that, then I might be, trying to persuade people that I'm young and hip. And that would be probably backfire.
The
But
key thing here is that when I work with people, the most common thing I try to correct in the early on is people for some reason have been told shouldn't be part of the story. And I think this is wrong, and Aristotle would definitely say it's wrong because he says of the three modes, character, argument, and emotion, the most important is character, especially when the truth seems uncertain, right? And so what happens is I get people and they never talk about themselves, or they don't think of themselves as part of the persuasion chemistry. And we always find something, sometimes more than one thing, where if that were mentioned to an audience, the audience would want to believe you more. This never fails to happen. It's just that people, for some reason, right, don't do it. And so you just ask yourself a simple question as a great tip. If you're going to talk to a group, what don't they know about me that if they knew about me would make them want to believe me? And there is always something, right? So that's tip number one. And people just don't ask this question. And so there you go, right? Here you have this wonderful chemistry you could be using. And you don't. And in fact, I say that when I coach people, they're like a ship with three masts, but only one sail is open, and that sail is called argument. Especially technical people, the character sail is tight. It looks like it's brand new, never being used, and the emotion sail was used once. It didn't work too well, so then they tied it up again. And
They
so
tied it up.
this poor argument sail is tattered. It has holes because it does all the work. And so if we just open the character sail, open the emotion sail, lower the argument sail, the work gets shared among all three, and the boat goes a lot faster and goes a lot farther.
Wow, that's so interesting, Carlos. And again, I'm thinking about so that management consultant persona, right? That the young man or the young woman walks into the room and they're wearing the black suit, the white shirt. They don't talk about themselves. I mean, they usually, to get where they were, they're probably a very interesting person, but they almost never talk about themselves. And I do believe that. I think what you're saying is true. When somebody comes in and says, well, we're going to make this transformation, we're going to do this thing, we're going to do this project, but I am a blank slate here telling you about this. I merely represent the will of your management. Then why should I believe you? Right? There's no reason for me to
The
believe you.
answer is there isn't any.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. All right. And that is a key, and it's a lesson I learned earlier in my career. So I'm very shy by nature. I'm an introvert, a massive introvert. And when I first got to consulting, one of the big four, my boss noticed this and he came to me and he said, "You need to fix this or get a different career. So I'm going to give you a job." He said, because we were traveling 4 days a week. So on Fridays, we were in the office, right? And he said, "Every Friday, I want you to find someone who has an office," because I was just an associate. "I want you to knock on a door and I want you to go into the office and I want you to ask them who they are and what they do. And that want you to tell them who you are and what you do." He said, "This is going to be really painful at first. And it will take you about 6 months to go through the whole building. But at the end of those 6 months, you'll either have quit or you'll have fixed this problem." Right. And it took me 6 months and it was painful. But at the end of the 6 months, I learned a great skill, which is how to talk about myself and what I do without coming across as arrogant, right? Or show-offy. I just learned to describe who I was to people. And it was one of the greatest skills or gifts that anybody gave in my career was tell me. And in fact, when I was the partner at Accenture and other jobs, and I had a new teammate come in, I would always ask them, "Tell me who you are, tell me what you do, and make it sound like work." So, and you know what? This sounds easy, but it would take hours sometimes. It would take hours to get rid of the value add, right? All these other sort of consulting words. They go, "No, just tell me in plain language, who are you? And what do you do for a living?" Right? And you think it's such an easy question, but This is one of the most painful things you can ask a consultant to answer.
Yeah, because you also then, and to truly answer that question, you really need to be clear on your own purpose, on your own goals.
An identity, right?
An identity, yes.
Right, exactly. Not the farms, not the projects, right? You. Because I don't want to believe PwC or Deloitte or Accenture. I want to believe you, right?
Yeah. So that there are these seven aspects that you've identified right. to character. Right. And you've gone over some of them. And as you said, most of us just dive in with argument. Yeah, you know, we're going to tell you, this is it. You know, lean is fantastic. Look what it's done for this company or that company. Right. Right. But so what are the seven or some of the seven elements of argument that we should be thinking about?
You have things like there's logic.
Mm-hmm.
Logic is a component, is a type of argument. Right. So these are deductions and inductions. We have logic. We have evidence. We have witnesses. We have authorities. The CEO told me to do that. That's in a call to authority, it's called. There are laws and standards. Laws are written rules. Standards are unwritten rules. Hey, in this company, we don't have lunch outside on Tuesdays. That's a standard, right? And so there are antecedents, traditions, right? And so so these are the things that we use in that quote unquote, hard part of the persuasion chemistry, right? And it's a strange thing because I tell people who love argument, I say, the more you are persuaded by the elements of argument, the farther away you are from persuading the average person. Because the average person is not able, first of all, because it's very hard to do argument at a high level. And second, because it's hard for the average person to follow it. In fact, if we were in a strict, let's call it philosophical logic class, and I asked the professor to explain a logical argument that lasted 60 seconds, I'm going to guarantee that almost every average person would be lost by about 20 seconds, not minutes, seconds, okay? Medical arguments, right? Lost in seconds, not minutes. And so we've all, I think most of that experience where somebody was presenting and it was a whole bunch of argument elements and we're just like, you lost me. Like, I couldn't follow you after the third slide, right? I don't know where you're going. And so what that audience is saying to you is that your argument is too argumentative. It has too many argument elements, or you didn't put them together in the right way, which is a very hard thing. In fact, we have schools to teach you how to do that. One is called philosophy PhD, right? The other is called,
most people don't go for that. Yeah.
They'll go to. The other one is called law school, right? Where we teach you how to build argument, how to persuade argument in a courtroom. And so it takes years to learn how to do this well. And I'm always surprised that people think, well, I'm really good at this, although I've never really learned how to do this the right way. So time and again, this is another problem with argument, is that people think they're good at it, but they're really not.
Well, I think it's easy for us. And again, I'm thinking about someone who's involved in, you know, lean transformation, you know, like we know the stories, right? We've seen evidence with our own eyes. And so in our own minds, it's laid out nice and cleanly. And hey, let me just show you this data, right? And I'll show you some data about employee engagement or about, you know, improvements to the bottom line or whatever it is. And look, isn't this data persuasive? And I can, you know, you can just see the audience, you know, whether it's in a boardroom or a classroom or wherever, you know, can see their eyes glazing over. It's like, where on the graph do you want me to look? And, you know, I can see myself in that situation. You're getting really excited, but look at here, look at this over here. Wasn't this this cool thing that happened? And they're like, is it time for a coffee break yet?
Right, so, because that either because the chemistry might be off or the sequence is off, right? Another error we make is that we don't, the formula is right, but the, you know, this, like, for example, again, think of chemistry and think about medicine, right? Sometimes you get to medicine. Doctor says, take this one first, wait an hour, and then take some. If you reverse that, it doesn't work, right? Mm-hmm. They're both individually correct, but sequence is critical. And so the same thing happens in presentations. All the pieces are right, but you didn't think about the order, right? And when I was a consulting partner and people would make presentations to me, I would tell them, I don't want to see anything in the deck except the headline. No, don't show me any picture. Okay. Storyboard the whole thing. I want to read the entire deck with no images, no graphics, nothing, just the headline. And it must convince me and be complete before anything is added. Because what happens? We fall in love with the graph and then we put a line to justify the graph's insertion in the story. No. Get rid of that. I will not look at a deck until every headline was written and the entire deck was signed off. Now that the story is written, now go and figure out what picture, what data, what piece of whatever supports the headline, right? And almost everyone does that in reverse.
You're right.
So, but in Hollywood, when you make a storyboard, you write the scene, the title, what it is, right? And then you draw it. You don't draw a scene and go, "Oh, wouldn't it be great to have this in the movie?" No, you say, then she goes here. Then you draw her going there. So that's a simple technique of just saying, okay, do you have the sequence right before you do anything else? Right. And people just don't spend time on this, which is why, in many cases, heavily argumentative chemistry fails.
And then that actually creates resistance, right? Because people are like, they're bored or they don't believe it or,
Well,
and they're.
it creates two things, right? I say when I coach, I say if you get argument wrong, you get confusion at best and chaos at worst, right? And so when you lose control of argument, you just have chaos because nobody knows what you're saying, right? And so confusion means I understand part and I don't understand part. Chaos means I don't understand any of it, or I got it completely wrong. Like you want to fire everybody, chaos erupts. You're like, no, that's not what I was saying at all. But you were so out of control in the argument phase that this person landed on a different planet. Like you're on the moon, and they went to Mars during this presentation, and now we got a problem, right? And so that's what argument is so tricky, and it's. Unfortunately, especially in the professional space, and I don't mean just business. I've coached professionals in the arts, museums, academics. They just love this stuff, right? And it just gets overused, though. That's really the problem.
I come from a science-based business background, and it's all about the data. We love data, and we love data in lean, and it's not necessarily. I love what you're saying. Like what's the thing? What's the scene? And then what's the data that supports that? What's the picture that you would show to support that? Not the other way around.
In a way, I used to put it with clients, goes like this, right? There are people and companies, right, for whom data is the road and for whom data is the scenery, right? And I've been in both kind of companies, right? A company that where he goes, where you go, look, I have all these statistics, and they go, I know, but my gut feel says this is the way to go, right? So data is scenery. A different company, you go, my gut says this is a bad idea. They go, no, but the numbers say it's this, so we're going to do this. Their data is the road. And your gut is the scenery. A huge problem arises if you're a data is the road person and you're trying to operate in a company where data is the scenery, right? And I'll give you a really good example. I work with a cosmetics company, right? And at that company, big company, data was scenery, right? The gut says people are going to love the fragrance called, springtime. Right now, crashed and burned, and you say, where is the autopsy on the crash and burn? They never did any. It didn't matter to them because the next designer would be inspired by, no, it actually should be fall. But the fall perfume is going to be a winner, right? And the company is very successful. It just operates with data is not the road, data is scenery, right?
Right. So that's up, and that is then. I love what you said. It's either data is the road and your gut is the scenery, or it's the other way around. So when you're saying your gut, now you started to talk about emotion, right? Like how we feel about things. So
Exactly.
tell us about that.
Right. So there we have this the same thing, right? There are seven kinds of emotion. There are positive emotions like happiness, negatives like anger, right? There are contemplative emotions that slow your brain down, like nostalgia. When I say, remember that? right? That slows you down to go back and recall it. There are mystical emotions, emotions you feel but can't explain. There are religious emotions, ones that are tied to religious practice, right? And so there are what I call exhortive emotions, which are emotions that call to action. Follow me, right? If you want to live, right? Like in the movie, right? And then there's inspiration, which people think they understand. I think people don't understand a lot because inspiration is the creation of desire. But to inspire someone means to convince them they're missing something, right? And so a very simple tip and a question that I ask people who call me and they're struggling, and I say, what do you want me to feel the moment you stop talking? And you'd be amazed at how many very senior people can't answer that question. Didn't even think about it. I said, you're going to go in. And I was talking to somebody who was trying to get a job as a C-suite executive, going to a recruiter, right, for his first screening interview. And I said, told me what he's going to say and the questions he had been asked. And I said, okay, that sounds great, but what do you want me to feel? He goes, what do you mean? I don't know. What do you want me to feel? You want me to feel happy, intrigued, relaxed, safe, right? And he had never thought about it. And this is also very common, where people spend a whole bunch of time on argument, and then I say, when you stop talking, or as you're talking, what do you want me to feel? And they ignore this question. And this is a problem, because emotion is kind of like the closing piece, right? It can make character and argument complete. It seals the deal, right? Or it can undermine everything, right? In other words, you had them, but then you did something, or something, and then unease or anxiety began to creep in, and you didn't address it. So when you stopped talking, all they felt was stress. And that just took away everything you spent the last hour doing. And I just went through this with somebody in a legal firm, right? Where they want to, it is kind of leanish, right? They want to bring in like operating standards, and they're going to operationalize a law firm, which kind of runs like, well, whatever happens, happens. And I said, what are they going to feel when you get done talking with this great new world that you're bringing in of efficiency and lean? And he goes, I don't know. I said, you know what it is? It's stress. It's stress, because you're going to change the world they know. And you haven't said one word about this in this last hour and a half, right? And if you don't address the stress that is in this room, they're going to leave, and you may think they're with you, but they won't be, at least not most of them. And so they redid the entire thing, right? And I texted them and said, how did it go? And they said, you were 100% right. We spent the last 20 minutes talking about the stress, and it all came out. How worried they were, right? Are people going to lose their jobs? It looks like they're going to be some winners and some losers. What if I don't get it, quote unquote? Am I going to be fired? And because we addressed this honestly, then suddenly they thought, okay, instead of leaving stressed, they left feeling safe that this consulting partner they could trust, right? And that's a completely different emotional state to walk out of a room in, stress versus safe.
And that is so key for the work that we do. I mean, the number one thing that we need to create is an environment where people feel safe and they actually are able to talk about problems and things that need to be improved and when things are not working. And without that safe environment, you can't do any type of
And then
improvement.
we go back to character, right? Because let's say you are there to make the place safe, but the people who hired you, their character history is of not making things safe, right? So management's character history is of using things like this to mess with people's jobs, or to downsize, or whatever, disrupt, let's just call it, right? You may personally believe that you're there to make the place a better place, and that you're operating from a place of safety. But the audience does not, because they see you as an extension of management, and management's character is not yours, unless you change it back to me, right? Unless you change. If suddenly you separate yourself, right, from management as different, then maybe you've got a hope. If you don't, and management's character history is negative in the eyes of the audience, your character history is negative because you're being linked to them. And so you think you made a presentation about how great things are going to be. That's not what they heard. What they heard is, here we go again. And I've seen this movie and it doesn't end well.
Uh-huh.
Right. And so, yeah, this is, and it's funny because I get asked to talk to groups about the book and the ideas. And I open with a slide, right? And the slide is a picture of a person playing the piano, kind of blurred, in front of a group, an audience. And I say, I want you to do a thought experience for me. Let's say you were trying to become an executive VP, or you're trying to make partner at a law firm, or whatever, a senior role. And you have to go to interviews and selection boards and screenings and get references, and it all goes great. You are candidate number one. Your job is yours. You're a shoo-in, right? You're shopping for a new car. Everything is great. And they go, wait a minute, only one thing left to do, and then the job is yours. Show up for this event. You show up. You're in this auditorium. And they say, just go to the piano and just play anything. You know, Mozart, Bach, Brahms, Chopin. You know, we don't care what you play. Just play something. And you go, wait a minute. Nobody told me about the piano.
Nobody.
Right. And they go, yeah, but all the executives who stay here longer than a year all play the piano. So we learned that if you can't play the piano, we don't make you an executive. Right. And you go, well, that's not fair. Okay. Replace piano with persuasion. You want to be an executive? Be persuasive. Where did I learn that? I don't know. You better go figure it out though. Right. And so it's just remarkable to me. And one reason I wrote the book is that I'm staggered by the fact that after working in the book for 3 years, that there is no profession almost, except maybe be king, maybe, I don't know, but even that probably, right? Where you don't have to persuade to succeed. And yet it's not taught in school. It's not taught in college. It's not taught in MBA school. It's not taught in science school. It's not taught anywhere. Right? So how are you supposed to be good at this if nobody teaches you? Hence the
right
book,
and I'm right? Just thinking, because I've worked with a lot of communication professionals, and I don't know that it's taught in communication school either. I think people could, you know, graduate with an MBA in communications
I take classes for my PhD in the comms department, and it's a very specialized topic even there, right? Most of comms is about PR.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of mass communication, mediated studies. So it isn't about persuasion. Persuasion is a very specialized topic. And so while it is studied by people like me and other specialists, for most people, they'll never read a book about this. And partly because there aren't that many books to begin with.
Yeah.
So, hopefully the idea behind the rules of persuasion was to give somebody a guidebook that they could read and understand, what is it? How does it work? And how can I put the chemistry to work for me?
Right. And so tell us the name of the book again.
Yeah, so the book is called The Rules of Persuasion. This right here. How the world's greatest communicators convince, inspire, lead, and sometimes deceive.
Right. Yeah, the deception part is also something to be aware of, right? That there is a possibility.
We go back to chemistry, right? And if because it is chemistry, chemistry is amoral, right? So you can use chemistry to make medicine, but I can also use it to poison you. And so persuasion has been used to poison people. And so there's a chapter in the book about how, when persuasion falls into the wrong hands, when the chemistry falls around, you wind up with things like the Holocaust, right? Which is a nation persuaded to commit this atrocity, and how it's happened in other places as well. And so, and when I look in that chapter, I identify 9 markers of linguistic chemistry that show that someone is trying to poison people. And the reason I picked these 9 is because all 9 are present in American social discourse today, right?
And
which means to me that, yeah, there are people trying to poison Americans with language.
Yeah, I can see that. It also makes me think about what happens when people are being scammed, right? Particularly these scams where the scammer establishes some kind of relationship, whether it's a romance scam or some kind of a
Absolutely.
Bitcoin scam with somebody, that they will stud out by establishing or trying to establish who they are as a character, that and creating emotion, creating, making somebody feel as if they're being loved even though they've been met, and also presenting some kind of evidence, some kind of argument, which is usually, if you
Yeah,
look at it
here's a
for a
gold mine.
minute, you'll see it's just not true.
Yeah.
But the character and the emotion will take people past the flimsy argument into spending their money, sending their money somewhere where they shouldn't send it.
Years ago, my mom was scammed by somebody who called her and said that he was a veteran raising money for veterans, right? And first he establishes his character. I served in Iraq, and he had a whole thing built up, right? And then showed her a fake website and told her that the money went to support veterans with PTSD, and she made a contribution, right? She told me about it. I went and checked it out. It was all fake, right? And it was a simple formula, which a little bit of character, mostly history. I was in Iraq, right? And then this emotional appeal. Oh, there are veterans suffering. Don't you feel bad? A donation today could help them, right? So the formula is very simple, and some of the most effective formulas are very simple, right? On both the positive and negative side, right? And so when people ask you for tips, going back to that, how do you? This sounds like a lot if I say there's a periodic table, but it really isn't. Just like in chemistry, right? The table has whatever 100 and something else. I always forget how many.
Elements,
But we don't work with most of them, right? We normally work with a small subset. In fact, I always joke, we have an entire year class on just one element, right? Carbon. And so it's called organic chemistry. And so the same thing happens here. It's only a few. And if you get good at a few, you can make all kinds of wonderful things with just a few elements, right? So I tell people, find one element in character that you feel comfortable with, like origin. Like, tell me about where you grew up. Something in your history, something you did, that makes me want to believe you. And then find one emotion that helps your cause, right? And then learn how to incorporate that into your presentations, into your talks, into how you ask for things. And that's it. It's a great place to start. You've got the argument probably already overdone. So the good news there is that less of that, a little bit of character, a little bit of feeling, and watch how better things get. And it happens again and again and again. And I get emails even from people who read the book and go, "I can't believe it works." And I go, "It works because it's chemistry. It's not me. I'm just explaining how this stuff operates. And if you do it right, it'll work for you too." Yeah.
That's really great. And so much of what we do, Carlos, is not standing up in front of groups and doing presentations and making a speech to the board or whatever it is. So much every most of what we do is individual interactions for lean leaders. It's that time at the Gemba with the people who are doing the real work. And I just imagine that mastering those elements and being able to call upon them as you're listening to people, and then passing information on, passing pers persuading people to take whatever the next step is, that practicing that can become part of who you are on a daily basis and not just something you do for your big presentation.
I agree. And in fact, that's the good news in this, right? Because I talk in the book about audiences, and there are four audiences. There's ourselves, because we have to persuade ourselves of things all the time. But there is the one-on-one, which is called dialectic audience. It's you and me, not a debate. Okay. A debate is one of us has to win. A dialectic is we're trying to find an answer, right? There is a defined, which is all the people in this room, right? All the Because it's a bounded set. And that's what's called the universal audience, which is anybody anywhere in time who could read your message. Most people operate alone or in groups of two. The good thing about groups of two is that if I go give a speech, I set my chemistry and I really can't change it once it's set, right? My speech is my speech. My deck is my deck. Whatever happens, happens. If it turns out that people are booing me after 10 minutes, not much I can do except walk off the stage. But when it's you and I in a room, I can gauge a reaction. and I can adjust the chemistry on the go, right? I can tweak. And really great communicators are able to do that. They're listening. There's a whole thing about listening in the book. And they're listening to see, like, the way a doctor looks at your reaction after they give you medicine, right? When you got a COVID shot, they say, stay here 15 minutes. Why? Because they're
Yeah.
watching that nothing goes wrong. The great communicator gives you the chemistry and then sits back and goes, how is it working? Right? Okay, you need a little bit of more of this, a little bit more of that. So, in fact, the easiest place to put the rules to work is in a one-to-one conversation. And
And
so,
then you can do your little plan, do, check, act cycle. You can do your
exactly.
little lean learning cycle
Back
right
to
there.
lean, right? Okay, this is what I
Yeah.
have in mind. I did it. Is it doing that? No, okay, then let's make a corrective action. You're right. You
Yeah.
can, you know, it's funny. Somebody asked me about what is the relationship between my book and books like Cialdini and other books on negotiation that have been kind of classed. And I said, look, we had medicine long before we had chemistry, right? So I think of those books as medicine. A great book on negotiation or on how to be an effective facilitator is medicine. My book is the chemistry. If it's a great book, it will use the rules I described, guaranteed. This is why that's a good book on facilitation, or why that's a good book on negotiation, right? It explains the why. And so this gives you a chance to write your own manual for how to do this well, I hope. Hope that's what the book gives me, right?
Carlos Alvarenga, how can people find you?
Easy enough. CarlosAlvarenga.com
Yeah.
is my website. And there you can find the things that I've written in the past and most that are coming out in the future. There's also a link to a newsletter I write on Substack called Critic at Large. It's not about persuasion, it's about art and culture and movies and those kinds of things. And so if you're interested in that, you can find it there. And of course, I'm on LinkedIn. And if you go to carlosfunger.com and you want to send me a message, please do so. I always like to give feedback, and I will always reply to reader messages to me.
That's great. Hey, Carlos, what is your one piece of advice for a young person starting out?
Become an expert in something. So
Yeah.
there are people who I think misunderstand the, like, when people used to Renaissance person, right, sometimes, or generalist, and I would always correct consultants who work for me, and I would say a Renaissance person is someone who transcends a specialty, not somebody who lacks one. Okay, and so at the higher you go, you must have a reason to justify you being in the room. So what is that reason? Are you a manufacturing expert? Are you a lawyer? Right? Are you a human resources expert? Where are you anchored in the world? Right? If having been anchored, you then add a second or a third specialty, that's wonderful. It makes you more valuable. But don't think you're going to get very far if you're just kind of working at the surface of most things. Right?
Of
And
most things.
it took me a while to understand this. But yeah, my advice is figure out, it's the foundation for the house that's called your career, right? Don't build one without it.
Wow, that's great advice. Wow. Carlos Alvarenga, thank you so much for traveling with me to the edges of lean.
Well, thank you so much for listening to a little bit about my work. Thank you to your audience for hearing the show. And it was a pleasure to be here. And thanks for everyone for joining us today. Have a great day.
This is Bella Engelbach, and I'd like to thank Carlos Alvarenga for being my guest at the edges of lean. What did you learn from this conversation? What did it persuade you of? What ideas did it spark? We would love to hear from you. You can find Carlos at carlosalvarenga.com. He's also on LinkedIn. His book is The Rules of Persuasion. Find me on LinkedIn or at leanforhumans.com or comment wherever you watch or listen. Don't forget to subscribe and check out all my friends in the Lean Communicators community at leancommunicators.com, where you will find lots of great new content every week. The Edges of Lean is written and produced by Bella Engelbach with support from Podcast Inc. This is a Lean for Humans production.